Welcome to the Alien Wellness Think Tank podcast series. The Think Tank is an emergency medicine organization led by residents for residents to improve the culture of wellness during residency training. Take a listen to our conversations with our wellness strategists and mentors.
Hey everyone, it's Nicole Battaglioli from the Wellness Think Tank, and today we are coming at you with a brand new podcast. We are joined today by a few other of our Think Tank members, Charlotte Roy, Shanna Nelson, and Jill Monzaluzzo, and we are talking with Eve Ekman. She's a PhD at UCSF and is a master in empathy and emotional awareness. And she's going to talk to us a lot about how to get through the holidays and how to get through this really dark time of the year. So I hope you enjoy this amazing podcast with Eve. Today we're going to be talking a little bit about stress, emotions, how to be aware of what kind of emotions you're having and how it relates to how much stress you're in. We all have very stressful jobs. And you also have some background in being a social worker in the emergency department. So you're going to tell us a little bit about what that was like and just kind of your path to what you're doing today. So welcome, Eve, and I'll kick it off to you.
Great. Thanks. Very happy to be here with you all, especially happy to be here in this holiday time, which requires a bit more resources and kind of consideration and being together. So just to give you an overview, I'm going to talk for about the next 20 minutes on a couple different topics, specifically around how the work of looking at burnout and the relationship between stress and meaning is relevant to the emergency room work and residency and healthcare in general. I'm then going to talk about an overview of what is stress and emotion from the scientific point of view and why do you care? I'm then going to get into a little bit of recent research I've done just in the last 2 years on how residents experience emotion on a day-to-day basis. And once again, why this matters to you and what we can learn from that. We're then going to do just a couple really brief experiential exercises. So to begin, I'm at Osher at the UCSF Center for Integrative Medicine. There's a couple Osher centers across the country. You may know them. Our specialty is working in integrative medicine and complementary and alternative modalities to Western medicine. So this may include acupuncture or Ayurveda, meditation and emotion regulation. And we have a pretty broad patient base and a pretty broad span of research interests. Mine is specifically managing burnout with meditation and emotion regulation for residents. And as you might imagine, there's not that many people in my center doing this work. So I'm really happy to be here with a group of people who I'm literally working for. I began my clinical work in the emergency room. I was a social worker at San Francisco General Hospital, in my humble opinion, the best emergency room in the world. And I was there for 6 years as a swing shift and night shift social worker. And I was thinking, just looking through actually some of my notes and journals from those days, about what it was like to work during Christmas. I am from San Francisco, so I would often take Christmas shifts because I didn't have to travel home. And I remember a couple different things about working there in the holidays, and maybe this will resonate for you all. On the one hand, you can feel a little bit of anxiety or maybe even guilt around not being home or not being where family is. That can make you feel even a little resentful at work. So there you are working and you're actual mood is kind of irritable. Maybe you're almost a Grinch or getting close. Then on the other hand, it might be the case that you're there at work and what you're experiencing is how our patients often around the holidays have a higher intensity of emotion as well. I remembered a specific case where there was a whole family that came in and the elderly father was dying that night. And though he'd been sick for many months, this was the most acute episode of him being in the hospital. And his family, who were familiar with the process, still just couldn't kind of deal with it being on Christmas. They kept saying, but it's Christmas. So we have this kind of exceptionalism around the holidays that can really increase our emotional responsivity. The other thing on the good side is that I think on the holidays too, I remember the break room being just filled to the ceiling with, you know, cakes and food. And as we eat our feelings, we're also building community. So there's also a nice part of being in the emergency room on the holidays. And I think that looking at one of the reasons I went back to school to study healthcare and burnout was in the ER, there's a pretty big group of people who not just survive their day, but really thrive in their day. They do the work with a whole lot of integrity. They bring compassion to their patient interactions and with their colleagues. And that makes being around them easy. I'm sure it makes their patients feel at ease. But then there's the other folks. And I wasn't doing research at the time, so I can't give you an exact percentage, but there are a significant amount of people who are burnt out. They are kind of showing symptoms that we would recognize as being disconnected, being cynical, just not really being, to say the very least, not being a team player, and to say maybe a bit more, making it hard to do your job well, because that attitude is pervasive and can really deteriorate a team. So I was really interested when I went back to school is how do we support both the people who are thriving and doing well so they can continue to do so. Life always gives us new challenges and we're always needing to kind of recalibrate our ability to show up and do this difficult and important work. And then also how do we help people who are really struggling, who are burnt out? So the first way I want to talk about this is talking about stress and emotion. So with an emergency room and any part of healthcare, but what we're going to do to reduce stress is unfortunately not going to have to do with making our patients less sick, right? There's never going to be less environmental obstacles, meaning there's always going to be new, challenging, and difficult things. And unfortunately, no time soon is our healthcare system going to get any better. So there's also always going to be those stresses and those ways that we can feel burnt out and overwhelmed. I'm going to focus, however, on what we do have a little bit more control over, which is our individual experience of stress and emotions. So when we think about emotions, we think about them often as something that gets in the way of doing our job, or we think about them as something that makes us enjoy engaging with patients and colleagues. Yet we often think about stress as totally separate. You know, oh, there's stress, I'm just feeling awful, I'm so overwhelmed and totally stressed. And yet when we look at the psychophysiology of stress, meaning both how we feel subjectively about stress, as well as what's going on in our body, stress is an over-arousal of our emotion. And that can be any emotion. So that can be that my irritation at having to work tonight when I thought I was going to be off, but my colleague is sick. My irritation leads me to the level of feeling overwhelmed by that emotion. So my stress is related to anger. We could also feel so anxious about a new rotation. I've never done this rotation. I don't know what's going to happen. I've heard terrible things about this attending. And our anxiety is such a high level that it's stress. So in these two examples, we see that stress is made up of a high level of different kinds of emotion. Now, I want to be clear here that not all stress is bad, and emotions are certainly not bad. Emotions actually have three main parts. We have a trigger to our emotion. We have an experience of our emotion. And we have a response. So let's use an example of irritation. If you feel triggered to irritation because you had to come in, your colleague called in sick, your experience is that feeling of irritated. Maybe you even notice in your shoulders are tight and your face is like crunched up. And then there's a response. Your response might be venting to a colleague. Oh my God, I can't believe I have to go in again. I'm so tired. This is terrible. Your response might be acting completely passive-aggressive for your whole shift. Your response might be kind of suppressing what you're feeling altogether and then going home later and taking it out on your loved ones. So same trigger, same experience, different response. And when we talk about managing and regulating our emotions, we're never going to get rid of triggers. We can't control a world. Certainly not in the ER, but anywhere else. We often have no capability to change our experience of the emotion. We're triggered, we feel it. Where we can start doing some work, and I say this very cautiously, because after myself spending 10 years doing this, I still, of course, struggle when I feel strongly pulled to irritation, to not act out in a passive-aggressive way or kind of making my voice heard. But we do have some room to work on our response. And that's really the important part. How do we work with our response to emotion? Now, really good news is that although we really have no choice or control over our emotions, we become triggered to emotions automatically by the world around us. We do have some control on how we observe our emotions, how we then work with our emotions. Now, Emotions are us responding to something important in our environment. We're not always emotional. We are emotional in response to something big, something worthwhile. So when we are not emotional, we have an opportunity to be working, to be focusing, to be on task, having cognitive processes. And what we can do is start to understand how our emotions influence our everyday. So the research that I've just been working on that I want to share with you is a study I've done. I did one study last spring and just completed one actually 3 weeks ago. And this is asking residents twice a day about their emotion experience for 10 days. Pretty simple study, just on their iPhone as an app. And the idea was asking the trigger to their emotion, the experience of their emotion, and their response. Now, it was a challenge just getting residents able and available to do this for 10 days, but I was very excited to start looking at the data and what I think it can show us. And so I'm going to share a little bit of that with you. So what we found, this will be no surprise to the think tank, residents are burnt out. So that was clear. You know, we had the high levels of burnout that you've heard reported in many, many journals. You saw high levels of perceived stress. You saw high levels of depression. And what I saw was during the day, asking again these 32 people twice a day to respond on their emotions, what was their most frequent emotion episode? So of my over 800 responses, 50% of all those responses was what emotion? I'm asking my panelists. What do you guys think?
Stress.
What kind of stress? Which emotion?
I'm going to go with irritation.
Irritation, okay.
Frustration.
Maybe anger.
Okay, anger, yeah. This is also what I would have guessed, and yet 50% of all the reported emotions were enjoyable emotions. So feeling excited, feeling joyful, feeling peaceful, and then followed up with 15% irritation and annoyance, 15% anxiety and rumination, and then other portions. Now, this was halfway surprising to me and halfway not. Partially, what we know is that our moment-to-moment experience can be quite different than how we report on our feelings of burnout. Burnout is kind of our overall, wow, when I think about the way that this institution works and my role in it, it's really hard. But when we think about our daily capacity for resilience, it's actually, you know, we're bumping through. We're having moments where we feel irritated, moments when we feel good. And this is a theory, I don't have data on this, but my guess is because we have such a high level of feelings of satisfaction and meaning in work, that we can really use some of our more difficult experiences and transform them. So the little data I have on that, burnout has a scale of personal accomplishment. And even though there's high levels of burnout, that personal accomplishment scale is still high. So we had this high level of enjoyable emotions, and then I looked at what were the triggers to the emotions, meaning what made people irritated, what made them happy, what made them feel sad or anxious, and what ended up being the number one source of anger, and pretty significantly, there was two main sources. One of them was feelings of frustration with oneself or what's going on in a personal life. Some examples of that are, someone wrote, I lost my sunglasses and I had a meltdown. Or someone else wrote, I have no idea how I'm going to get out of this financial hole, right? So just feelings of frustration. And then the second, the follow-up, was feelings of frustration with significant other, family, or friends. Things like, my husband doesn't appreciate me. Or my friend showed up drunk, right? And I found that really interesting, not because, well, I understand why people would feel frustrated or annoyed or angry by that, but that work was not as high on this ranking of what was making people angry or irritated or upset. I presented this back to residents a week later and was asking them about this finding. And what one of them said was, well, we're not allowed to be angry at work. So we're angry when we get home. And I thought this was a really interesting insight and an area we can start really considering of how to do targeted interventions to manage some of our emotional experience at work and maybe choose to not have it leak at home or be aware of that, bring attention to it. Now with fear, meaning anxiety and kind of feelings of anticipation, the overwhelming majority of the trigger to fear was work-related. So feeling overwhelmed with deadlines, feeling not knowing what to do, feeling like I'm at the edge. So that was very high with fear. And then with sadness, what we saw is the main sources of sadness were personal related, meaning feeling isolated, feeling alone. Someone wrote, I'll never find a romantic partner with this kind of schedule. I'm hopeless. Another person just writing, I never get to see my friends. I miss my life, right? And then the other big piece was feelings of sadness because of patient encounters. So I saw a patient who I couldn't help, whose life is incredibly sad. And again, we know this, right? We know that there's sadness. And sadness actually only made up less than 10% of all the reported emotions. And we can have many questions as to why people reported more anxiety or anger. There's a pretty common theory in the science of emotion that sadness doesn't feel good, so we usually try to cover it up with a different emotion. Usually that emotion is anger. Instead of feeling sad and helpless, like I can't do anything for this patient who's dying, we blame someone or something. Well, if someone had done something earlier, I could have done something, right? So we kind of move away from those feelings of sadness because they're so difficult. Now, if we think about these emotions, especially in our holiday edition here, I think especially looking at how much we have these feelings or responses of anger that we bring home with us, it's a good one to keep in mind, you know, especially feeling, as I mentioned in the very beginning of this talk, maybe we even feel resentful just at the moment of having to be at work. So if we want to be looking at our irritation, we want to be making kind of a little bit of assessment, what am I bringing with me? So that's a good thing to think about. And I think also importantly, because social support is so important, we need to also be focusing on being with other people. So the two main sources of enjoyment that people reported were activities of well-being. And for residents, of course, those are different than for maybe the civilian world. So they don't have as many opportunities for long periods of vacation or rest or exercise. But people found little ways to kind of manifest their well-being, whether that's I got to sleep in for an afternoon or I made myself breakfast and listened to reggae. These are the kind of things that people reported of their well-being or self-care. And the other big source was other people, social support, just being around friends or being around colleagues. Now, on the holidays, this is really important. We have the people we think we prefer to be with, right? But I assure you, pretty much any good company is good company. It can really help you savor and engage and feel good about the work you're doing. Now, when we're thinking about now, what does it mean to look at our emotions and understand them? What do we do now? Okay, we have anger, we have frustration, there's this enjoyment, which is wonderful. How do we work with these emotions? It's really simple. So we're going to do a couple brief exercises. So the first one, and I know many of you may be listening to this, you know, in a recorded form while you're doing laundry or making dinner or whatever else. So I'm just going to ask you for the next minute to stop what you're doing. And you don't need to have any kind of formal sitting practice. You can definitely be standing. You could be lying down. But I am going to ask you to close your eyes. It's easier to filter out other information. And so to just close your eyes for the next minute. And I'm going to guide you through two different scenarios. So in the first scenario, I want you to bring to mind a time recently when you really felt like you were missing out on being with friends or family. Maybe it was a birthday party or a baby shower, or even just a simple night at home with your loved one. Bring this one memory to mind. Choose one. And as you're remembering what this feels like, notice if there's any sensations in your body associated with this emotional memory. Do you notice any tightness in the jaw, sensations around the face and the eyes or forehead? How about the neck or shoulders or chest? Or sensations in the belly, arms, or legs. And really pay attention to any sensations. Are they warm or tight, tingling? Does it feel heavy? And then open your eyes back up. And if that exercise didn't bring a whole lot of sensations to mind immediately, to body, rather, you can try this again by choosing your favorite sad song and just listening. And noticing what you're feeling in your body. Now, we're going to do one more of these brief exercises with a different emotion. And maybe this one will be more successful for you, or maybe it'll have different sensations. So once again, just briefly, closing our eyes. And this time, bring to mind a recent experience where you had a really awesome connection with someone important to you in your life. This could be something very simple, like reading in bed, or something enormously joyous, like a wedding, graduation. And once again, with as much detail as possible, really bring this memory to mind. And then notice and focus on any sensations you might be feeling in your face, around the eyes and the jaw, and the neck and the shoulders and chest, around the stomach, arms and legs. And just one more breath, focusing on the quality of the sensations that this memory might have brought to your body. And then blinking your eyes just back open. So hopefully you might have noticed a difference between those two memories and what it felt like in your body. And there's two main reasons that we try this embodied practice of emotion. One of the first reasons is we really need to be able to understand our experiences of emotion as they're occurring so they don't build up and stress us out. That's essentially the only way we've learned through however many years of applied psychotherapeutic and scientific examination of emotion regulation, is making sure our emotions aren't getting over-aroused over time. And so by paying attention to our emotions and recognizing when they're arising, we might have a better sense of, man, I've been pretty sad all day. God, my body is heavy. Or, geez, I am tight. I think I'm frustrated today. Often, we only notice we're in an emotion by our behaviors. Right? We notice when we've decided to turn down everybody's call for us to go to dinner or hang out, and we've just at home underneath the covers watching Netflix. Not there's anything wrong with that, but it may be a sign of sadness if we're truly withdrawing. And the same for anger. We don't notice the levels of irritation in our body until we're just kind of losing it at someone in a way that we regret later. And what this practice is of being aware of our embodied experience of emotion, interoception, is getting a lot more attention in the world of psychology and the science of meditation. We realize that not only is it a good way for us to be aware of our emotions, it's actually a good way for us to help reduce some of our more ruminations. So if we're feeling upset or frustrated, like I never get to spend time with my friends, residency's ruining my life, I used to have all these people I spent time with and now I don't even know who they are, who I am. That is a rumination process. And when we ruminate, meaning when we think about a trigger to an emotion, we actually are experiencing that emotion. So we can be triggered from the outside event, like, sorry, I can't come to dinner, or from thinking about, I can't go to dinner, I can't go to the baby shower, I can't go to this. Yet when we focus on our body and the sensations, really quickly, you might have noticed this if you did this experiment alongside, those sensations start to dissipate. It actually leaves our body. Emotions only last about 2 minutes, except our re-triggering of them in our mind makes them last longer and longer and longer. So one of the name of the game of working with our emotions is noticing what emotions are we feeling? Can we get that information from our body? And if we are noticing that we're feeling some kind of difficult feelings or sensations, can we just wait with them in our body? Notice them, not say, God, I wish I didn't feel this way. What's wrong with me? Or what's wrong with someone else? But wow, my palms are hot. My neck is tight. And let it pass. It will. It will pass within a couple minutes. So this is a great strategy you can apply actually throughout the workday. There's so many instances when we are triggered to a difficult emotion, working with a patient or a colleague. Maybe we've been put down by a superior and we're feeling a little embarrassed or ashamed. And our tendency is to kind of want to just swallow all our feelings and hide inside. Now I have news for you. Though that is a temporary strategy, it doesn't actually work. It actually is more taxing on our kind of entire autonomic nervous system than simply noticing that emotion and letting it pass. So again, one of the best ways to manage our emotions as we notice them arising, taking that second, training ourselves to observe, pay attention, and let it pass through. So these are some really brief exercises, and I know I'm going through them quickly. I shared a link on Slack and I'll share it again. I have a bunch of 3 to 6 minute guided practices that you can use at any time. It's in conjunction with a live training that I've been doing for residents in pediatrics and family community medicine. So the next thing we're going to do is very brief, and we're not going to think about anything in particular, but we're once again going to use our body. Now, this is a practice that really helps us find relaxation that is also focused. So generally, we think about relaxation as just kind of drowsy, falling asleep, margarita by the pool, or more likely passed out in the break room, right? That's when we're relaxed. And yet, one of the things about meditation that can be really helpful is it trains us to have a relaxed sense of focus. So usually when we're focused, we're tight, we're kind of activated, and we're like getting it done. And yet, we can learn to also have a practice where we're focused and relaxed. One of a good way to do this, once again, is with our body. So in this really short practice, what we'll do is we'll take 3 breaths of letting our mind focus just on the experience of our sitting body, and then 3 breaths of bringing our attention a little bit more focused into our stomach, and then 3 breaths of attention just to our nostril. So we do a total of 9 breaths, and honestly, I really invite you to give this a try. It's like taking a 10-minute nap. And more reliable. Because sometimes you try to take a 10-minute nap and you can't fall asleep or your pager goes off. This you can do in the elevator. You can do it right after you finished a note. And it really gives you a whole refresh. Again, it's allowing your mind to rest in one place. What makes us so tired is our attention is here and then it's there and then it's here and then it's there. So we're giving our mind this opportunity to rest just in our body. So once again, whatever you're doing, just kind of get comfortable. You don't have to be formal position at all, lying down or sitting, standing up. You can have your eyes open or closed. It's sometimes easier closed. It can cut out some other distractions. And we begin with a breath in which we inhale and focus on the sensations in our body. And we exhale and we relax and we release that attention. Inhale, noticing and attending to the sensations of our body. Exhale, release. And once again, inhale, noticing the sensations of our entire body breathing. And exhale, release. And then shifting our attention, we bring in our next breath to notice the sensation of breath through our abdomen. And exhale, release. Inhale, noticing the sensations of skin as it stretches over our belly. And exhale, relaxing and releasing. Last breath here on the abdomen, noticing and intending to the situations and sensations. Exhale, release. Then narrowing in our focus even more. Inhale, noticing the sensations of air passing in through our nostrils. Exhale, release. Inhale, noticing once again these subtle sensations of air traveling in through our nostrils. Exhale, release. And last one. Inhale. Through our nostrils, resting our mind in that attention. Exhale, release. Then gently blinking your eyes open if they've been closed. And just notice for a minute if there's a different quality of your attention. And again, I invite you to give this a try. See how it goes. It's pretty easy to remember. You don't need a phone. You don't need a checklist. You can just, okay, body, abdomen, nostril. The key point here is having both that attention and that relaxation through our inhale and our exhale. So the last thing we're going to do together is I'm going to ask you to think about a recent episode of emotion. This is a nice way to think about this emotion training. So to bring to mind an emotion episode recently and think about what was the emotion I was feeling? Was it frustration? Irritation? Was I feeling happy? Was I feeling sad or lonely? Any recent episode, and I'll give an example just from one of the many I have from residents. So I had one of frustration. Think about how intensely you were feeling that frustration. A little bit or a lot, maybe just in the middle. And then think about, did you notice any sensations in your body with that frustration? In my data, I found that the majority of people felt anger in their shoulders, their jaw, and around their eyes. And people started to pay more attention to where they felt emotion in their body. So where did you feel it when you had this recent emotion?
I definitely tend to have anger and frustration, and I notice my shoulders kind of sneak up, and I do like you mentioned, you kind of feel it around the eyes. I hadn't noticed that before, but now that you pointed out, I think that that's true as well for me.
I'm definitely a jaw clencher, especially on the right side of my jaw. I can sometimes I'm doing it and I don't even notice until I start thinking about it, and I have to consciously sort of relax that muscle and try to bring it back into normal alignment.
Good.
For me, I tend to clamp down on my pen or clutch some, like, the white knuckles when people are angry driving. Like, that's me at work, like, when I'm, like, strangling my pen silently.
I'm a jaw clencher.
Yeah, the jaw is really, really common with frustration. And then, you know, we think about, okay, I'm feeling these feelings of frustration. Do you remember what triggered it? Do you remember what led to that feeling of a recent emotion?
Yeah, most of the time I feel like there's an inciting event. This was a terrible transfer situation where someone wanted to transfer someone to me that really should have gone somewhere else. And it just ended up with yelling with the doc at the other hospital. And he used some not so nice language. And I was trying to keep it cool. So that was definitely the inciting event as my shoulders creep up and up and my face gets more scrunched.
Yeah. Did it help, the yelling with the doctor? Did they rescind the transfer?
No, it didn't help. It didn't change anything, but I just felt like I had to fight the good fight. I don't know.
I think it's important to say here that anger is like a great emotion. It's important. It helps set boundaries, and especially when like some matter of justice or safety is involved, it's really important. Anyone else remember their recent anger inciting event?
Oh yeah, it just happened last night. I threw like a hissy fit while cooking. We were having a big potluck and I realized I did not make nearly enough sauce. And then my husband tasted it and he was like, oh yeah, it is. Cause I was like, ah, there's not enough. It's too bland. He's like, yeah, it is a little bland. And I just lost it. It was not pretty.
Do you think it had to do with something else, like leading up to that anger in that moment?
You know, looking back, cause I did feel like a 2-year-old, like I threw a fit like a 2-year-old for about 1 minute. And then I just made more sauce. I think it was, but I'm still trying to figure out what it was. I mean, holidays are always rough in general, especially as a resident, but I don't quite know what. I think it was an accumulation of things, and that was just kind of like the one that tipped it over the edge when he agreed with me. That's what he gets for agreeing with me, obviously.
Yeah, I feel like I'm having a hard time kind of pinpointing one big thing, because I think very often it's more like the accumulation of hundreds or thousands of little things, and I think that's definitely like a hard part of our job, that there are so many small frustrations that you have to deal with every day. Sometimes my significant other bears the brunt of that built up frustration.
Yeah, I think it's just when my to-do list, looking at my to-do list, I like have to crack my jaw after I like take a look at it because I'm like clenching too much.
And I think, you know, it's kind of unintuitive to pay more attention to our emotions. We're like, why would I do that? They're already overwhelming my life. And yet that kind of looking back and tracing what trigger leads to our experience and then how that response might actually lead to our next trigger of emotion and how that next emotion might lead to the next one, that gives us some valuable information. And one of the reasons I asked the residents to be looking at their emotions every day was to give them feedback on, and the app kind of populated this for them, what are your most common emotions? What are the most common triggers to those emotions? And what are your responses to those emotions also? One of the big questions to reflect on is, was my response helpful? Did it help manage whatever it was that was triggering me? And this is not an opportunity to get down on ourselves or, you know, feel like, oh God, I'm such a terrible person. With anger, we often have that. It's more to look at, are there these kind of predisposing factors that make my responses to emotion regrettable, right? Regrettable emotional episodes is what we're trying to avoid. We don't want to avoid emotions. If there's a bad transfer, it's a great example. If there's a bad transfer, it might call for some anger, right? There's got to be some advocating, some way to be known that this is not okay. And yet, being aware of our emotions can help us kind of communicate in the best way possible. I kind of wanted to, you know, get ready for your questions, which I'm excited about, by just saying that, you know, we say this word resilience a lot, that we're looking for resilience, and there's a lot of definitions. From the point of view of emotion, resilience just means our ability to have our emotions come and go, come and go, and to not hold on and to not get stuck. And resilience also means that, especially from our difficult emotions, we can learn and transform. So it's not simply, okay, can I just muscle my way through these feelings and then I'll be okay? But is there something these feelings are teaching me and showing me? So we look at the resilience literature from early psychology, early childhood psychology. It's not just that little kids who go through a great deal of adversity make it. It's that they become like better, right? They're more hardy somehow. And there's a belief that for us as adults, that's possible too. And a lot of it has to do with this capacity to notice our emotions and apply this appraisal of, wow, why am I upset? Why is this happening? How can I learn from this? Oh, this is part of my job. And I chose this job because I love it. And it means a lot to me. And that sounds so cheesy, but reminding ourselves of meaning on a daily basis is probably one of the most useful buffers to stress other than exercise. Exercise is the best. Everybody knows that. Runner-up is reappraisal of meaning, connecting to our sense of meaning in our work. And that could be something really small. It could just be, wow, I got to be a supportive listener for one of my colleagues today. Or, yeah, I made a breakthrough with a patient and she disclosed some important information and now I feel I can send her home safely, right? So really allowing ourselves that time to savor what's good and to work with what's challenging. I will also post this on Slack, but I'm opening up to do a across all schools resident study of emotion in this spring. So if you're interested, please message me and we'll be doing another study and you can track your emotions and learn more about your daily habits. So excited for your questions.
Eve, thank you so much. I feel like that was just so much awesome advice and information. And I really like what you said about emotions really only lasting a couple of minutes, but it's really your re-triggering that makes them last longer. And I feel like I don't have to be chained to something that happens during a shift and makes me angry. You know, if we can just focus on what caused it and say, okay, great, and move along, I don't have to be in a bad mood the rest of my shift. Yeah. And my patients and colleagues don't have to suffer because of it. And so I thought that was really kind of stuck out to me as like a aha moment. I know we've got some questions here. Charlotte, I'm going to kick it off to you. Do you have any questions for Eve?
Yeah, so I'm now wishing that I had reminded myself of what exactly I heard you say. Probably a week or so ago, watched, I think it was a video, and you were talking a lot about compassion and having compassion for patients. And one thing I wanted to ask you, because it was something I think about a lot and I was thinking about when I was listening to you discuss that subject, is dealing with the frequent flyer, or for in this hospital, I think frequently it's sickle cell patients. We have a lot of, it's a by far predominantly African-American population, and we have a number of patients with sickle cell who come in once a week, twice a week, three times a week, patients that, you know, all of us know. We all know the name, we all know who they are. And I have such a hard time figuring out how, you know, I think there's sort of two ends of the spectrum. One is that you have compassion for these people, which you should. but then sometimes you feel a little bit like I've had nurses come up to me and say, oh, just so you know, this person comes here all the time and they always act like this, or this person is drug seeking. And so then I think you're made to feel a little bit foolish for being compassionate, like you're a pawn in their game. And on the other end of the spectrum, you know, there've been times where I think, well, I don't believe this person and I'm not playing their game. And then I feel like I'm just being mean and not the best doctor I can be. And I have a hard time kind of navigating that interaction. So yeah, to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, thanks. I think that's a great question and an ongoing struggle. And again, especially relevant in residency, but you know, throughout life, right? How do we care for people who maybe aren't caring for themselves and maybe aren't actually caring for us? and potentially even doing things that might be threatening or harmful, kind of calling us a bad doctor, you don't care about me, you're not trying to help me. I hear this a lot from residents who I work with at SF General, you know, and the getting the label drug seeker for a patient, and then them being very angry and upset about that label, and a lot that goes on. And, you know, it's interesting. I think it's really important to distinguish compassion from pity or sympathy, and being really clear that compassion, at least from, you know, informed by the Buddhist perspective, but that what we can use in a secular way, is that compassion has many arms. So there's one arm that's very like maybe a warm embrace and is, you know, really caring. But there's an arm of compassion that's also quite fierce and sets firm boundaries and says no. And you can do that still as long as you have the intention of, I wish this person had less suffering, and I wish they could overcome so many more things than I have control over. And I think the danger, like one of the things that happens is there's not that many options. When you feel someone's distress, you can either respond by pouring your heart into them, which everyone probably does for a couple months, and then you're exhausted. You're like, can't do that anymore. So you can kind of like get upset with them, almost resonate to their suffering. You can kind of distance yourself and be like, that's not happening to me. Actually, it's probably their fault. Like you're saying, like they always do this. They always come here. Or we can have this more like a stance of compassion where no matter what is arising or whatever we're dealing with, we're still with this intention. Like, it is my wish that this patient could have as little suffering as possible. But right now that means I'm actually not going to fill this prescription for them, or not going to do this thing they want me to do. But you know, and your motivation is still clear of one of compassion. So it's weird because you're like, well, but I'm still doing the same thing. But it really is in what can give us the most peace of mind. And the most peace of mind will come when we're acting out of our own values. And everyone who decides to put so much of their life into this program, one of the main core driving values is helping others. And just keeping that close to you, right? Even if it's just, let's say, symbolic, like in between every patient, I have one resident who does this, who in between every patient, before she like opens the door, she's like, thinks of her compassion. I really want to be compassionate for this family. I really want to show up. I really want to be present. And whether, no matter what happens once you're in the room, you've set that compassion as a stance or a way of being. So I know it sounds very ethereal, but my suggestion is to give it a try, because the other options are, again, so much more stressful. So, and I have some 6-minute and 3-minute compassion meditations that you could try online to see what it's like. Not that you need to meditate every time you're having a difficult experience with a patient, but it can be helpful as just guiding your breath of, this person is suffering, I wish they weren't suffering. That might be the most you can do for them. But doing that does help kind of reinforce that goal without giving too much or without becoming hardened and cold.
Thank you so much, Eve. Thank you so much for coming on here. One of the hardest emotions that I deal with around the holiday season is guilt, actually, and I'm not quite sure how to process it, whether it's because a family member loses a loved one on Christmas during my shift and I feel guilty that that's going to be with them forever, or the guilt from my family and not being present in the holidays because I live in a different state, things like that. I feel like it is that it's your core set of values that you feel like you're compromising at that point in time. How do you suggest that we kind of manage that emotion? Because it is, for me, of all the emotions, I think anger is a good one. I think these are good ones. Guilt is one of the ones that I feel like I have such a negative connotation every time I say it, because I feel like we shouldn't feel guilty for these things. And yet it is an overwhelming process that we deal with.
Yeah, great question. And a colleague of mine at UCSF, Larissa Thompson, who works in internal medicine, we've been doing a really small study on guilt and shame in residency, just an interview study. We do think it's a really important target area of emotions in how we work with them. Now, just to clarify, you know, guilt is, I did something wrong, and shame is, I am wrong. And they often can go hand in hand. And with guilt, usually, or hopefully, there is some motivating piece of it. Like, okay, I did something wrong, I'm going to try to fix this or figure it out. Whereas with shame, it can be even more isolating and distancing, because we're like, I'm bad. Someone's going to find out. If they knew, they'd even think I'm worse, right? So these can be separate, but one can kind of tip over into the other. So with guilt, you know, it's interesting. It's an emotion that when it has been studied, it never gets a lot of popular attention, except for with Brené Brown. So I feel like we're really lucky that a researcher, Brené Brown, who's done a lot of qualitative interviews with people about their sources of guilt and shame and how people live in their life without those, that research has really been enormously important. And interestingly, probably the most important part of the research is simply making known these feelings. So it's often said that it's very hard for guilt to exist when it's being exposed to the light. So when we're kind of showing it to other people, when we're sharing it and expressing it. Guilt is something that is much easier, like shame, when we kind of hide it away, and that creates the distance. A lot of guilt can get in the way of us doing self-care as well, right? So sometimes there's guilt, like, why should I get to go to the gym when all my patients are in the ICU? Or I don't deserve to do something good for myself tonight. I haven't even done what I was expected to do. And so with guilt, you know, kind of the antidote is really working on, if possible, small steps of reminding ourselves how we are deserving of love. And it doesn't even have to be like, oh, me, Eve, I'm so special and deserving of love. More just, I'm a human who suffers, and I'm struggling just like everyone else, and I'm also deserving of love. So I think especially when we're feeling in our most extreme guilt or shame, we kind of start with a compassion that's not like a defense, like, well, but I can't go home to help this person, or it could have been anyone on the shift helping this family. We really focus just on this basic level of, wow, everybody wishes to be not feeling alone. Everyone wishes to be feeling loved and cared about. Me too. I'm one of those people. And then we like edge in towards, you know, better ways of appreciating and caring about ourselves. So I wasn't able to do that, but I am able to at least like send my mom a text message, let her know I love her. She may not be available for it. I might not get the response I want, but I know that I feel bad not being present, and I'm going to do what I can. So that's a specific kind of around the holidays recommendation. In general, I think the best way to work with guilt and shame in residency is by having groups together and by having conversations, not just free form, but really specific on, okay, everybody, let's talk about the last time we felt guilt. What was the trigger? What was the experience? What was the response? So using these kind of specific tools of looking at emotion and then comparing those experiences. The reality is there's no kind of one set of strategies, but we're such social creatures. We learn so much by social interaction, and guilt and shame are both what are called self-conscious emotions. They wouldn't exist if we weren't thinking about how we are in community with others. And so the best way to work with them is in community with others.
I think that's so helpful. And I agree with you, Shanna, those are emotions that we have all the time. And you, they've looked at different triggers of burnout or things that can make burnout worse, and missing family events and missing out on family obligations or things that you feel like you should be doing was definitely one of them. Part of the reason why we wanted to have you on this time of year is because we feel like it is kind of the darkest time. You know, the days are shorter. It's dark when you wake up. It might be dark when you go home. The holidays are around, and maybe you don't have the opportunity to go home and be with your family. And we start having some of these emotions and having frustrations and maybe feeling kind of down and isolated. One thing that's important to us in the think tank that we kind of want to bring up and talk about is when these things kind of go to the extreme and result in docs and other folks in the medical community either trying to commit suicide or taking their own lives. Do you feel like this is something that is, you know, we're kind of maybe more susceptible to around the holidays or this time of year? And then I wanted to see if we could touch on, you know, you're talking a lot about being aware of our emotions. How can we be aware of when those emotions are maybe more negative or kind of heading in the wrong direction?
Yeah, that's such an important topic. And I do think it's great that there's this forum to talk about it and to connect with others. And, you know, many of you, especially working in the ER, of course, you see a lot of cases of people who are feeling so desperate to escape from their emotions that they want to take their own life. And there's a couple aspects of suicide that relate to what we've been describing this evening, especially just talking about this issue of guilt and shame. There's a lot of overwhelming feelings of guilt and shame about suicidality. So we feel ashamed to tell people that we're thinking about this. What will they say? Will they judge us, right? And feelings of completely being overwhelmed and stressed to the point of just complete fatigue. There's just no way I can get everything done. This is impossible. How could I do this? And that also, you know, we can feel ashamed about asking for help and needing support or extra time. I think things like this think tank, and we're so lucky that the ACGME is taking into account wellness. So in their new competencies around the work environment, they're really prioritizing wellness. It's maybe taking a bit long to make this a priority, but better late than never, and there's going to be a lot of work. But I really think as much social connection as possible. I think those of us who want to be supports for people we see who are really deeply emotionally suffering, we feel a little helpless. We don't know what to do. And you don't have to approach someone and say, hey, I notice you're significantly depressed. Are you feeling suicidal? We don't need to be a clinician to our colleagues. But we can say, let's get together. Let's just talk. You know, let's just spend these next 5 minutes like talking. What's going on? And they may not say or reveal to you maybe the deepest experience of what's happening. But if we can lead with vulnerability for them, like, I'm feeling overwhelmed. I don't know what to do here. This feels like too much, but I know it'll pass. And we don't want to be too quick to fix things. I think not only do people not want to be made to feel weak for expressing their vulnerability, they also don't want someone to tell them it's going to be okay. We just need to be heard and experienced for our authentic feelings and emotions. I think if we're monitoring ourselves, if these are feelings we're having, that we have to look at our behaviors. To feel sad, to feel isolated and lonely, it's a normal part of, yes, this time of year, work that is so challenging and hard, being front and center witness to all of the miseries of life. You know, losing people we love, losing physical capacities, having our lives changed inalterably in ways that are painful. How do we just cope with that reality? I think we have to be paying attention to our own emotional experiences and how we attribute ourselves to what's happening to others. So there is this important ability to see and witness our emotions without getting lost in them. And strange as it may sound, those simple practices of focusing on our breath and our body and watching our emotions, this really helps train our mind to be an observer. So to help us notice our emotions, honor them, be with them, but not get lost in them. And it's an everyday practice. We're totally not used to it. We are completely caught up in this idea that whatever's going through our mind is reality, that we're just going to run with it. Where in fact, we have this ability to kind of step back a little, to watch, to notice, and to pay attention. And that can really give us a little bit of space, inner space. May not have it on the outside, but wow, this is what's happening. This is what I'm experiencing. I think when we're in the most extreme feelings of sadness or anger or frustration, meditation isn't really available for us. It's too agitating or upsetting. It's a great time for journaling, writing just 800 words, just trying. There's so many great solutions out there. These are just a couple, but I guess my kind of final thoughts would be for others to really be present and vulnerable if you're noticing that someone is suffering. They don't need to tell you their whole story. You can just show them that you're struggling too and invite their authenticity. And if you yourself are struggling, really trying to notice what's happening and reach out to others. It's as intense as it may feel to share those feelings. It also breeds a lot of intimacy. That kind of share and disclosure creates the kind of connections that are kind of invaluable in life too. So not being as afraid of or reluctant around the shame and looking at the other side of it too.
Oh, Eve, thank you so much for touching on that really important topic and a topic that we're not, you know, always really sure how to deal with or how to approach, especially when it comes to colleagues or folks that we're close to. I think we're getting towards kind of the end of our time. So Eve, thanks again for being on. We look forward to working with you again in the think tank. I think people are going to be really get a lot of tremendous value out of the discussion here. I think we touched on a lot of things that are so important. Before we go, I do want to touch on a couple of announcements. First, if you're a resident, please take a look and consider joining us for our first ever Resident Wellness Consensus Summit. This is being done in conjunction between EEM, Essentials of EM, EMRA, ALEM, and us, the Wellness Think Tank. And this will be happening at Essentials of Emergency Medicine next May, May 15th, in Vegas. So great place to come out and collaborate with us and focus on wellness. Again, this is resident only, kind of doing a ground up grassroots consensus summit here. So take a look. If you want to sign up, you can start by going to EMRA's page and then looking at the HIPAA EM section of your benefits page. So check that out. Let us know if you have any questions. And then a big shout out to the sponsor of the Wellness Think Tank, US Acute Care Solutions. Thanks a lot, guys, for supporting us and helping us out. And we look forward to seeing everybody next time in the Wellness Think Tank.
And that wraps up a great episode from the Wellness Think Tank. Special thanks to our exclusive sponsors, US Acute Care Solutions. You can reach us also on Twitter at WellnessTT. Until next time, remember that residency training should be about thriving and not just surviving.